It's Thursday, February 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State may be gone from Iraq, but their handiwork remains.
Basically, in Western Mosul, we find explosive hazards in every street, every house, every alley, every piece of infrastructure. There are explosive hazards.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejects the recommendation of a corruption indictment, and two big R&B stars get together for a new song that's climbing the charts. It's all ahead on International Edition. A grim beginning today. A former student who had been expelled for disciplinary problems was arrested in a shooting Wednesday at a Florida high school that left 17 people dead. Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel, calling it a horrific day, identified the alleged gunman as Nicholas Cruz and said police had arrested him off school grounds without a struggle. Cruz had multiple magazines and one rifle, the sheriff said. Israel said 12 of the victims died inside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, about 72 kilometers north of Miami. Three others were killed outside the school, and two died of their wounds at a hospital. At least 14 others were wounded. Maziel Baluja is a student at the school and was there at the moment the shooter started firing. She recounted her experience to CNN.
Well, it was a second fire alarm that went off today around, 2:22, and we were, suspicious because we already had a fire alarm drill going off, so we weren't sure if this was a real fire drill or not. And apparently, I guess the shooter pulled the alarm so he could have kids going out on the hallway to shoot. And I was on the top floor, and then right below me on the first floor, I heard shooting, and I saw two guys running. I wasn't sure what it was, and then I heard it again, and that's when me and a group of people just ran downstairs, and I could tell he was on my left side because that's where I heard the gunshots from, and it was very loud. And then I went to make a right, and I just ran, and I had my book bag on my back just in case I got shot from the back. It would go through my book bags and my books. I ran to where there were students and teachers, and we went to Westleaf, and then from there, I knew it was a real shooting because I saw three helicopters, and that's when everyone was just all men for themselves, and I jumped the fence, and I just ran with my book bag on and everything, and I was in front of Westgate for about 20 minutes, and then after that, we got escorted to Walmart, which is right next to Westgate Middle School, and then there, as I was walking, literally a few feet from me, I see cops screaming, and I see a kid in handcuffs. I guess I was one of the suspects. So needless to say, I was basically endangered two times in a row, different times, and it was just very scary. And then my mom was across the street trying to get me, but the cops had us on the floor for about 20 minutes, and my mom was just there waiting for me. And I was with a whole group of kids, and I didn't know if any of them were shooters or not, so I felt very uncomfortable because anybody could be a shooter.
President Donald Trump offered authorities all federal help they need and tweeted his prayers and condolences to the victims and their families. Quote, "No child, teacher, or anyone else should ever feel unsafe in an American school," he tweeted. But Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut blamed Congress for what he called a scourge of school shootings. For the record, this is the 18th school shooting in the U.S. since January 1st. Here's some of the top stories trending at this hour. A new report details harm to U.S. diplomats in Cuba, but offers no cause. South African President Jacob Zuma resigns. The U.S. House begins investigating resigned White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter. And porn actress Stormy Daniels says she's ready to talk about an alleged affair with Donald Trump. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA. The This is International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, known for his lengthy, dogged quest to end the regime of President Robert Mugabe, has died just months after the longtime leader caved to pressure and stepped down after decades in power. His life's mission took its toll. Tsvangirai, who was 65, succumbed after a long battle with cancer. With more, here's VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg.
Even in his final months, Morgan Tsvangirai did not slow down in his life's mission to bring political change to Zimbabwe.
That in the interest of the people of Zimbabwe, Mr. Robert Mugabe must resign, step down immediately in line with the national sentiment and expectation.
He got his wish shortly before his death. In late 2017, Mugabe resigned after 38 years as president. His right-hand man, Emmerson Mnangagwa, was sworn in to replace him. Tsvangirai never got to lead his movement for democratic change to victory, but his supporters say his efforts were what mattered.
Morgan Tsvangirai is the first man to actually have the bravery to stand against Mugabe and bring about the results.
Tsvangirai challenged Mugabe time and time again, contesting Mugabe's quest for the presidency in 2002, 2008, and 2013. Elections marked with repression, violence, and irregularities. He spent nearly as much time on the campaign trail as he did in jail for an assortment of politically motivated trials and arrests. He also tried to make peace with the longtime leader, joining a government of national unity and serving as prime minister from 2009 to 2013. That move was met with mixed public reaction, and the coalition eventually fell apart. He will be remembered most for his tenacity, says analyst Gideon Chitanga.
He did not flinch, he did not betray the struggle for democracy, he did not surrender. He even sacrificed his victory in 2008 to try and accommodate the military regime in Zimbabwe, fronted by Robert Mugabe, as a way of facilitating a smooth transition to democracy. The challenges of that period we can discuss about, but I think that he is probably one of the greatest statesmen Zimbabwe has ever produced.
He'd been fighting colon cancer since 2016. But in his own way, in the end, he won the bigger fight that kept him going for so long, seeing the end of the Mugabe regime. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In keeping with tradition, Pope Francis marked Ash Wednesday by leading a procession on Rome's Aventine Hill before celebrating Mass in the Basilica of St. Sabina. Leading the world's Catholics into the season of Lent, Francis urged the faithful to slow down and rediscover the power of silence. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Ash Wednesday marks the start of the Christian holy season of Lent, which runs until Easter, and Pope Francis held his traditional Mass in the 1600-year-old Basilica of Santa Sabina. A cardinal rubbed ashes on the Pope's forehead, and the Pope did the same to other members of the congregation in a ritual that reminds Christians of their mortality.
Tempo di Quaresima è tempo propizio per correggere gli accordi dissonanti.
At the start of his homily, Pope Francis said the season of Lent is a favorable time to remedy the dissonant chords of our Christian life. The Pope urged the faithful to pause a little and leave behind the unrest and commotion that he said fill the soul with bitter feelings which never get us anywhere.
Fermati un po'. Lascia questa agitazione, questo correre senza senso.
He called on people to pause from this compulsion to a fast-paced life that scatters, divides, and ultimately destroys time with family, with friends, with children. During Lent, Christians are urged to either fast or give up something they enjoy as a sign of humility. It is also a time when they are called to reflect on how to improve themselves and help those in need. The Pope urged the faithful not to forget compassion.
Fermati un po' davanti al rumore assordante
He told the faithful to pause for a little while, refrain from the deafening noise that weakens and confuses our hearing, that makes us forget the fruitful and creative power of silence. On February 23rd, the Pope has invited Catholics and members of all other religions to observe a day of prayer, fasting, and initiatives for peace, urging the world to say no to violence and conflict. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is Science in a Minute.
Watching astronauts float in the weightlessness of space may look like a lot of fun, but scientists have found that such an environment can also have negative physical and psychological effects on humans. German scientists say they have found another effect of weightlessness. It can produce a higher body temperature. Detailing their findings in a new study published by the journal Scientific Reports, the scientists found that after being in space for about 2.5 months, an astronaut's body temperature, on average, rose to about 38 degrees Celsius, 1 degree above a normal reading of 37 degrees, even while at rest. Lead researcher Dr. Hans Christian Gunga, a space medicine specialist, explains that it's really difficult for our bodies to rid themselves of excessive heat in the weightless conditions such as those experienced by astronauts. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. I'm Doug Bernard. The United Nations Mine Action Service reports Islamic State militants have left a deadly legacy of tens of thousands of explosive hazards and improvised explosive devices in cities throughout Iraq, preventing the safe return of people to homes they were forced to flee. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
War in Iraq has displaced nearly 6 million people since 2014. More than half since have gone home. But the UN Mine Action Service reports an estimated 2.6 million people remain displaced. It says cities retaken from Islamic State militants are heavily contaminated with explosive hazards, improvised explosive devices, and other lethal weapons, preventing people from returning home safely. It says as soon as areas are liberated, risk assessment teams are deployed to survey the situation, with clearance activities following as soon as possible. UNMAS Senior Program Manager Per Lodhammer says 45,000 explosive hazards and 750 improvised explosive devices have been removed from several retaken areas. Explosive hazards refer to ammunition that has been fired but has failed to function. He says clearance operations now are mainly focused on Fallujah and on western Mosul, which was retaken by Iraqi government forces and a U.S.-led coalition in July 2017. He describes conditions in western Mosul as very dangerous.
The need is so big. Basically, in western Mosul, we find explosive hazards in every street, every house, every alley, every piece of infrastructure. There are explosive hazards. People are publicly stating that they will not return to their homes and their houses because of explosive hazards, because they know there is contamination.
Lodhammer says clearing explosive hazards must occur before any rehabilitation or reconstruction work in Iraq can be carried out. He estimates it will take more than a decade before western Mosul is cleared. He says UNMAS will need an additional $216 million beyond what it already has received for clearance and stabilization operations in Iraq this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Israel, all eyes are on Israel's attorney general as he considers a police recommendation to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption allegations. Avichai Mandelblit, a former Netanyahu cabinet secretary, was selected for the job by the prime minister. The police acted after a year-long investigation involving two cases, dubbed 1000 and 2000, one of them involving both a Hollywood producer and an Australian businessman, and the other allegations of a deal between the prime minister and a newspaper publisher over more favorable coverage. Mr. Netanyahu denies any wrongdoing.
בשנים הללו הופעלו לחצים כבירים לפתוח נגדי.
In a nationally broadcast address here, the Prime Minister said multiple checks and investigations have been launched with the aim of toppling him from power. All these attempts, without exemption, he said, ended with nothing. Yosef Olmert is an adjunct political science professor at the University of South Carolina and a Middle East scholar. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the police action is a preliminary step in a process that could take up to a year to complete.
So it is not posing an immediate political threat to him because his coalition partners are all standing behind him, but obviously it might detract, you know, from his authority and credibility and leadership altogether, and it will open up for speculation that all kinds of decisions that he is taking or may take could be influenced, you know, by his immediate personal considerations regarding these allegations. So altogether, it's not a good situation for him, but as yet, it is not an immediate danger to his continuing being the prime minister.
Well, he's on track to becoming one of the longest-serving prime ministers in Israel.
He already is. He already is. He surpassed even the founding father, David Ben-Gurion.
Well, how serious are the charges?
The charges, if you ask me, are ridiculous. I mean, in a country like the U.S., they would not even come to, you know, anything like that, because basically one of them is that he was dealing with a publisher of a newspaper about changing editorial policy of this newspaper, which is against him, in return for the newspaper which supports Netanyahu changing their policy against the other newspaper. You know, it's almost like a joke. The other allegation is about friendship that he has had with a billionaire, an Israeli billionaire, who owns also a television channel in Israel, or partly owner of a television channel, and that he supplied him, this billionaire, champagne and expensive cigars in return for something which is not even clear what it was. So if you ask me, I mean, I'm not a legal advisor, not a legal expert, of course, the allegations in terms of the substance of them are not really very serious, but the very fact that there are allegations and there is a recommendation of the police now, that in itself is a significant political blow to him.
Yosef Olmert insists that Mr. Netanyahu's political future is not threatened as long as his coalition partners continue to support him. He said he sees the likelihood of one of them withdrawing their support ahead of elections, which must be held by late next year, as remote. Well, Wednesday was Valentine's Day, a romantic holiday where people give cards, flowers, or gifts to one another. If you're lucky, candy is especially popular, and one of the best places to find an unusual assortment is at the True Treats Historic Candy Store in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. The shop sells an abundance of sweets that were popular during different periods in history. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, that makes picking the perfect Valentine's gift deliciously difficult.
It's a love fest for sweets at True Treats in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, the only historic candy store in the United States. The shop opened 8 years ago and features everything from ancient Greek chewing gum to 20th century classics.
Violet, rose.
The first commercial candy appeared in 1806. Customers enjoy reading historical backgrounds on the candy labels.
It's fun to see the progression through the years of the different kinds of chocolates and candy.
Owner Susan Benjamin offers customers interesting tidbits about the 400 products on display. Surprisingly, sweets were first used for health problems, says Benjamin.
Sugar were used as a medicine, and the Turkish delight was made for sore throat somewhere around the year 900, and it became very popular worldwide.
People also chewed on bark, branches, and roots.
In the mid-1800s, when kids would go and buy a root of licorice plant, and they would chew it and get that delicious licorice flavor.
A popular novelty item at True Treats is a bag of roasted bugs with crickets and mealyworms, once considered a sweet snack. In the 1950s, ant wafers made their debut.
The crickets to me taste a little bit like sesame. And I've had ants, which some of them are a little bit bitter. They're almost tart, like a lemon.
Small, round fruit and nut chocolate candies were popular from the 1920s to 1950s with people who played card games.
They made little candies that people could pick up with their fingers in one hand and then hold the cards in the other.
Some customers find candy that brings back memories.
Probably seen this, 18 years ago or something, but now it's here. I can have it.
Others are too young to have grown up with any of the candy in the store.
I came here a lot as a kid, so it's a kind of lot of nostalgia, which is weird because it's in such an unfamiliar setting, yet I have so many fond memories.
For people who want to know more about candy's guilty pleasures, Benjamin has written a book called Sweet as Sin about the intriguing evolution of these confectionery treats. Deborah Block, VOA News, Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
And you're listening to VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. Finally for you today, two musical artists are joining forces for a song that's rising on the charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London spoke with our Sarah Williams about The Weeknd and Kendrick Lamar.
Today, we're talking about a couple of the hottest R&B artists on the planet. They've combined their talents for one hit song, and I'm referring to Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd, who have a song together on the soundtrack to the new film Black Panther, which is the Marvel Comics superhero film that's opening up in the U.S. theaters this coming up weekend. And everybody's talking about how great this this movie's supposed to be, the special effects and whatnot, and of course the music. So Black Panther film soundtrack, which came out last Friday, Pray For Me is the name of the song with Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd, and it debuts at number 7 already on the Billboard chart. So let's listen to it, and then I'll tell you all about Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd.
Who gon' pray for me? Take my pain for me. Save my soul for me. Cause I'm alone to see. If I gon' die for you. If I gon' kill for you.
Now, how did these two get together to do this project?
Well, it's kind of a lucky roll of the dice situation. Kendrick Lamar was given the task to produce the music for the film soundtrack. So he kind of oversaw everything that took place as far as the recordings and who recorded with who. And it just worked out so that The Weeknd was available and recorded the song with Kendrick Lamar. The two of them, incidentally, not together, separately, are also now nominated for a Juno Award, or at least one Juno Award, March 25th in Vancouver, British Columbia, when Canada hosts its equivalent to the Grammys, the Junos. And recently at the Grammy Awards, Kendrick and The Weeknd also both left the award show holding on to at least one award. So they have definitely been on a roll, both of them. We all have been reading where The Weeknd was dating Selena Gomez, and that relationship just ended. Kendrick Lamar, he's won everything this past 12 months that he was nominated for, the BET Awards, the Billboard Awards, MTV Awards, and now the Grammys. And Kendrick also appeared on a radio show in New York City, and he opened up about his childhood and how he decided to get into music. He mentioned that he believes he was abducted by aliens when he was 6.
Okay.
He said he actually saw a spaceship in his backyard. They came and they took him. And he said that it's probably the reason that he has the musical gift that he has. because something that the aliens did to him and with him. Now, I don't know if this was all tongue-in-cheek or if he meant it sincerely, but he did say that on the radio, and he sounded awfully sincere when he said it. Now, Kendrick's current album is called Damn, and he spent a lot of time this past year in the top 10. His latest release is called Love, and it was recently in the top 5. It's kind of slipped a little bit, but Kendrick Lamar remains the hottest thing in R&B and pop music right now today in the United States.
Is that because of his abduction experience?
It could be. It could be. We're all abducted. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe we've been programmed. But Kendrick Lamar, he's been doing this for quite a while, and he's put out quite a few hits already. And his album, as I say, Damn, is doing well. And so, you know, Kendrick Lamar is just, he's an icon in the business at a very early age. He's quite young, and this is early stages for him. But yet everybody's looking up to him, and everybody wants to work with him. So it's good to be Kendrick Lamar these days. And it's good to be the weekend, too.
Okay, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I fight the world, I fight you, I fight myself, I fight God, just tell me how many burdens left. I fight pain and hurricanes, today I wept. I'm trying to fight back tears.
And that's International Edition for this hour. Thanks so much for joining us. You can find all the top news 24 hours a day at our website, voanews.com. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States warned the Iranian government that it holds Iran fully accountable for the well-being of detained U.S. citizen Bakar Namazi. Mr. Namazi, who is 81 years old, was recently returned to Evin prison after a brief furlough. He has been hospitalized 4 times over the past year for problems relating to his heart. We understand the decision to return Mr. Namazi to prison was made against the strong advice of his doctors and the Iranian regime's own medical examiner, said White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders in a statement. Bakar Namazi, former official with UNICEF, was arrested in Iran in February 2016. He had traveled to Iran to visit his son, Siamak, who had been detained by the authorities 4 months earlier. Both men were tried in secret proceedings and in October 2016 were sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage and collaboration with the American government. An attorney for the Namazi family, Jared Ginzer, said that returning the elder Namazi to prison was tantamount to a death sentence. Deliberate denial of necessary medical care in these circumstances raises serious concerns of human rights abuses. In her statement, Press Secretary Sanders said that Bakar Namazi remains in urgent need of sustained medical care, and the United States government holds Iran fully accountable for his well-being. She reiterated the Trump administration's call for the unconditional release of all unjustly detained and missing United States citizens in Iran, including Bakar and Siamak Namazi, as well as graduate student Xiaowei Wang and former FBI agent Robert Levinson, who disappeared from Iran's Kish Island in March 2007.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.